I am really excited about tonight and very happy to be here once again. Appreciate everybody being here tonight, especially any visitors we have in our midst. But tonight's lesson, I told you this yesterday, I think it's maybe the most important lesson we're going to talk about. When I was preparing this lesson, it dawned on me that there's a lot of science in this lesson, and I'll sort of apologize for that a little bit right now. There's a lot of science in this lesson. There's not going to be a test afterwards, though. I'll tell you that. But by the nature of what we're talking about, there has to be that. But there is a lot of science. Before the night's over, you're going to know how protein is made. You may already know that, but you're going to learn it tonight, how proteins are made in our body. That requires a little bit of science. But you know, a great man once said that science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind. That was Albert Einstein. And then way before Albert Einstein, Galileo said, I don't feel obliged to believe the same God who endowed us with sense, reason, and intellect has intended for us to forego its use. So there's nothing wrong with science. Sometimes science gets a rap by the religious community. Proper science, there's nothing wrong with it. And so I do apologize a little bit for the fact that there will be a lot of science, but let's don't forget our purpose. And I've mentioned that before in these lessons already. Hebrews 4:12. It's not science that saves. It's not evidences that save. It's the Bible. It's the Holy Scriptures. It's the gospel. Hebrews 4:12 says, for the word of God is living and active and sharper than any two-edged sword and piercing as far as the division of soul and spirit of both joints and marrow and able to judge the thoughts and intentions of the heart. That's what saves us. These evidences are trying to get someone who is open-minded. They have to be open-minded. If they're already closed-minded, forget it. It's not going to work. I get that. But the open-minded person has the ability to learn this stuff and realize that there is a creator, that this didn't all occur by chance. The other thing I thought about is, where did this all begin? We're going to be talking about DNA tonight. Who made DNA? Think it just popped in naturally? That's what the naturalists say. And it dawned on me, who made what we have on earth today? Who made it? One of my favorite passages. Go to John chapter 1. John will tell us where everything came from. He says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God, and all things are made through Him, and without Him nothing was made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men, and the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. Who is that verse talking about? It's talking about Jesus Christ. And that verse says, or those verses say, that nothing was made without Him. So the things we're going to be talking about tonight, although again, there's science involved, God was responsible for that science, but He has intended, I think, for man to learn some of these things. And that's what we're going to look at. But learn it with the idea, like Einstein said, science without religion is lame. It just is. So we're going to look at what has been referred to as the language of God. Not my term, but Genesis 2:7 says, then the Lord formed man of the dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and men became living beings. This verse doesn't say DNA, but we understand that this is where I talked about on Sunday morning, that sometimes we can say figures of speech or figurative language. Maybe that's what this is. It's the dust of the ground. Well, we know that man is not made of silicone. It's not literally the dust, but it's made of the materials. We're made of material. We're made of molecules. That's what life is. And that important molecule is DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, discovered in 1953. Again, a great year. Here I was born. One of the young ladies yesterday had calculated how old I was. I kind of wish I hadn't done that now, but you know what? She was right. She didn't know what month, but she figured it out. It had to be one or the other. But anyway, the genome was decoded in 2003, decoded by a fellow named Francis Collins. Now, before the night's over, you're going to learn a little bit more about Francis Collins. Very brilliant man. He's an MD, PhD. He has a degree in a medical degree as well as degree in genetics, and he was actually assigned by President Bill Clinton to do the Human Genome Project. And it was felt that it would take a long time to decode, quote-unquote decode. You're going to learn what that is tonight. It would take a long time for us to decode DNA. It actually happened very quickly with the aid of computers. It really was decoded in not only the DNA of human beings, but other animals have followed suit. They haven't decoded every animal out there yet, but chimpanzees have been decoded. Other mammals have been decoded. And Francis Collins claims to be a Christian. He claims to be a believing Christian. He believes in the miracles of the New Testament. He believes in the historicity of the New Testament. But he also believes in evolution, which kind of floors me to be such a bright man. And when we're going to see, you know, why he believes that tonight. But he does believe in evolution, a certain type of evolution. And he says that what lies between the genes plus the findings of similar sequences on the genomes of distantly related organisms gave powerful support for Darwinian theory. So much support that when the genome was released, when we found out about the genome, the evolutionists, they had a field day. They said, "This is it. This is gonna squelch all the debate about whether evolution is true or not." And Philip Kitcher said that the intelligent design movement is a dead science. He at least gave it credit for being a science, but he said it was dead because of what was found in the human genome. And we're going to study that. I kind of gave that as a teaser to let you know what we're going to look at. But the people that discovered the genome thought it was a death bell for religion. Well, let's talk about DNA just real briefly. I'm interested in history. People that know me know I'm a little bit of a history buff. But James Watson and Francis Crick discovered the structure of DNA. Actually, it should have been 1953, not 1957. But these were kind of two unlikely heroes, if you will. They were not supposed to be the people that discovered the structure of DNA. We had known about DNA for a long time. The molecule was actually discovered in 1869. 10 years after Darwin wrote his book, On Origin of Species. Didn't know the complete molecular processes of it yet, but the DNA was discovered by Mischer in Switzerland in 1869. Then in 1909, we discovered the chemical makeup of DNA. We knew that it involved basically two nitrogen bases, adenine and thymine and guanine and cytosine. And what was interesting about that was that when you found those molecules in the DNA of an organism, there was always the same exact amount of adenine to thymine and always the same amount of guanine to cytosine. Now, the ratio might have been different between those two, but there was always exactly the same amount. And that's going to be important when we talk about the production of proteins in just a minute. Well, there was a very strong push to then, once we knew the chemical makeup, then the structure became important. And it took a long time, for this almost 50 years, for the structure to be found. And there was teams in Chicago, Linus Pauling and his group. You had teams in England. You had several teams there. And then you had these upstarts, James Watson, who came from Chicago and moved to Cambridge at the age of 23, barely had his PhD. Francis Crick, who was a physicist who had yet to receive his PhD, and they started working on the structure of DNA as well. Nobody would have ever thought they would have done it. But by looking at radio diffraction carried out by Rosalind Franklin, who didn't get nearly the credit she should have gotten for the discovery in DNA, they became to realize that the DNA was a double helix, and everybody in this room probably knows that. I know all of our high school students that have studied this know this, and most of you in the audience know that. And it was a coiled molecule, a double helix. And they began to understand that the nitrogen bases were the inside of this molecule. And they were bound to each other by this hydrogen bond. And on the outside, you had the sugar molecule and the phosphate molecule, which were really only for structure. That's all really what they were there for. Peculiar thing is A always bound to T and G always bound to C. And they published this and, of course, became famous for that thereafter. And the rest of their lives were always known for that great discovery of the structure of DNA. Crick very early on realized a little bit, probably more than Watson. And Watson was really the more chemist and biologist. But the physicist, Francis Crick, understood there was something going on here. when you had A always binding to T and C always binding to G, there might be something to that. And he referred to that as the sequence hypothesis. And the sequence hypothesis was maybe it's the order in which these are lined up on the chromosome in the DNA molecule that was responsible for life and for the structures of life, primarily the proteins of life. He hypothesized that. He didn't know that, but it seemed to make sense to him. Well, guess what? That's exactly the truth. That's what it turned out to be. So when you talk about decoding DNA, you're decoding those sequences of nitrogen bases. That's what that is. And that's what they've decoded in human beings. We have the full DNA code. And what became very, very obvious is the way that those nitrogen bases lined up would determine what proteins were made. And we have hundreds of proteins in our body. Think proteins are pretty important? Of course. We couldn't be alive if you didn't have protein, if our bodies weren't made of a protein. So we started referring to DNA as the source of genetic information, the genetic message, the genetic blueprint, assemblies of instruction, the digital code. Do you see a theme in all of this? It's information. DNA is information. That's what it is. What is information? Information is communication or reception of knowledge or intelligence. Where did it come from? That's the big question, isn't it? Even Francis Collins knew how unlikely this was. He's an evolutionist, supposedly a Christian evolutionist, but he understood. He says, no current hypothesis comes close to explaining how in the space of a mere 150 million years, that's his years, not mine, but those are the years the evolutionists like to use. Again, you remember our talk from yesterday, mutations take a long time for things to change, but where in the course of 150 million years, the prebiotic environment, we don't even know there ever was a prebiotic environment. That's totally postulated. It's kind of silly. But in that span of years, we don't know how DNA could have existed in that span of years. How did it come? How did it give rise to life? There's no theory, hypothesis, that even comes close to explaining that. Stephen Meyer, he says evolutionary theory could not explain the origin of the first life because it could not explain the origin of genetic information in DNA. The evolutionists, they say, well, evolution is a mutation in the gene. Where do you get a gene? Well, first you get DNA. Well, where did you get the DNA? You know, there was an old, Steve Martin had a sketch years ago. He says, how do you get rich? He said, first give me $1 million. Then I'll get rich. Well, that's what this is. Where did life begin? Stephen Meyer says it's impossible for evolutionary theory to explain that because they can't explain where DNA came from. DNA, very interesting molecule. Very interesting molecule. It's a 6 billion letter code. 6 billion letter code. There is the chromosome 1 has 270 million base pairs. What are those base pairs? That's the A to T, C to G. That's what base pairs are. And it has 750 billion of those. The DNA molecule is a very, I would say, skinny molecule. If you were to take the DNA out of one cell and to stretch it out, it would be millions of times its length versus its width. And it would stretch out to be about 6 foot in one cell. You have 50 trillion cells in your body. If you were to line up all the DNA in your cells, it would stretch to the sun 600 times. To me, that's just an amazing molecule. And that's what we have in DNA. And I point out here, those 270 billion base pairs in just one chromosome, if you were to line those letters up page after page after page, you would have a 200,000-page book for your first chromosome. And we have 23 pairs of chromosomes. But here's the thing. The DNA molecule, as remarkable as that molecule is, it's really nothing special. It's special how it got here, granted. But the molecule is the message It's the messenger, it's not the message. It's the code that's important. It's how those nitrogen bases were ordered that's important. That's what DNA is there for. And even our friend Richard Dawkins has noted just how remarkable DNA is computer-like, because it's how those bases are lined up that determines what our proteins are. I'm going to show you this. Chromosome codes for protein production, amino acids in a sequence, and the average protein has about 100 to 150 amino acids. This is how it works. For every amino acid, there is three base pairs that code for that amino acid. So every amino acid has a code of three base pairs. It's all different for each amino acid. Now, it gets a little more complicated. Some amino acids have more than three base pairs, but let's just keep it simple for right now. The average is about three base pairs per amino acid. And then it's when those amino acids are lined up in exactly the precise order that produces whatever given protein you're trying to produce. And again, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of proteins in the body. That's how protein is made. When the DNA molecule unravels, you've got the base pairs in their order. You have ribosomes from the cytoplasm of the cell going into the chromosome. They line up perfectly with those letters, the opposite letter. If it's A, then T is going to line up with A. If it's C, then C is going to line up with G in that precise order. It's going to take that information that's inside the nucleus, take it back outside to the ribosome, and that's where proteins are made. So I told you you're going to learn how proteins are made. That's the very simplistic version of it. You have to have the code to produce the proteins. You can't make the protein without the code. It's just like a binary code in computers. We probably have a lot of people in this room that are computer savvy. I'm not, but I know that it's a binary code. That much I do know. And it's this binary code that codes for your computers. And if you had a binary code, if you had a book that was in a binary code, it might look something like this. This is the code for when in the course of human events, etc. That's our constitution. This is the binary code for that. It's very simple. You put that in your computer, out pops when in the course of human events. Do you think those letters, those codes, those zeros and ones put together happen to just assemble like that purely by chance? Well, of course not. What had to happen? Somebody had to put that in there. Some individual, someone with intelligence, had to put that code in there for that word to come out when in the course of human events, etc. Genetic information is no different. It's just a lot more complex. It's a lot more complex than our binary code. Ultimately more. Stephen Meyer, in his book, Signature in the Cell, he gave this genetic code. This is a genetic code for one protein. It's called an RNA polymerase. That's not important. You don't need to know what the protein is. What you need to know is all those letters lined up perfectly like that produce that one particular protein. That one particular protein. That's how proteins are made. That's how all the proteins in our bodies were made. So once again, what's the million-dollar question here? Million-dollar question is, how did these digitally encoded and specifically sequenced instructions in DNA arise? Where did they come from? It's information. Information had to come somewhere. At least that's what we realize that today. It'd be silly to tell someone that information just pops in without any intelligence behind it. Nobody would believe you. But that's what we're led to believe about this remarkable molecule and how our bodies are made. And to me, it defies logic to not understand that. And we see that the complexity of DNA is nowhere to be found in nature. We don't see this complexity anywhere else. So it couldn't have occurred naturally. Some people will say, well, it's like crystals. You know, crystals can form, and they form in this sequence, or it could be like snowflakes or whatever. Here's the deal. There's no information in those crystals. There's no information in those snowflakes. There's information in DNA. We wouldn't be here if that information wasn't there. So, if you're an evolutionist, how do you get DNA? This comes from William Dembski and others. But DNA must come from either chance, law-like forces, meaning it had the necessity have come together just the way it was, or a combination of both per evolutionary doctrine. That's the only two choices you have, because remember in our talk about evolution yesterday, evolution is blind. It is non-directed. It is pure chance. That's what causes evolution. So if you're an evolutionist, you got some explaining to do. And so this is it. It has to be chance, or it has to be a law-like force. I can tell you this. When you start talking about chance causing something, chance doesn't cause anything, does it? It's not a cause. And it's an argument of ignorance, in my opinion. Chance doesn't cause anything. And to use it as an explanation is an explanation of ignorance. And we're the ones considered to be ignorant. That's what surprises me. I'm talking about creationists. We're the ones who are considered the ignorant ones. We don't use the word chance. It wasn't chance. It was directed. It was directed by God. Now, I'm going to get into something that I call the law of probability, or you might call it the law of improbability, whatever you want to choose. I'm going to make this real simple because I'm a kind of a simple guy. Some of you know that I play golf. Dub and Ron and John and several others, Scott, know I play golf. Let's say I had a 6-inch putt, straight 6-inch putt. Dub, do you think I'd make that? Where's Dub? I'm back there. Do you think I'd make that? He's saying yes. He's saying yes. I would say there's a pretty high probability that anyone out there in the audience would make a 6-inch putt. Make it smaller. Make it a 1-inch putt if you want to. And I would say we call those gimmies in golf. You know, that's a gimme. It's amazing how long those gimmies can get. But especially when I'm playing Joe Turlington. But that's a different story. But most of us would make that putt. Now, let's say instead of a 6-inch putt, you're going to give me a 100-foot putt that's a left-to-right breaker on a very slick green going downhill. What's the probability of making that putt? Even me. Even me. It's real, real low. But given enough time, I might make that putt. But we would call that an improbable thing, wouldn't we? The first thing is very probable. The second thing is very, very improbable. But now, put a blindfold on me and tell me to putt it 100 times and tell me I got to make it 100 times. That downhill 100-foot slick putt, it ain't going to happen. It's just not going to happen. That's what we would call a very improbable thing. That's the kind of numbers we're going to look at, only they're even more astronomical than that. For example, you may not think this would be very, very improbable, but let's take flipping a coin. And I tell you, I want you to flip that coin 100 times, and this is much easier than making that 100-foot putt. But you're going to flip it 100 times, and it's going to have to come up heads 100 times in a row. Do you know what the likelihood of that is? I know you don't. But, I mean, do you think that is a likely thing? We would call that probably an unlikely thing. And I'm going to give you the number. I don't know how to describe this number, except it's 1,267,690,600 with 7 3 zeros behind it. 7 numbers of 3 zeros behind it. I don't know how to describe that number. And that's just flipping a coin 100 times heads in a row. You could be doing it for trillions of years, and it would never happen. That's a very improbable thing. So the only reason I make that is because we use real big numbers when we talk about these things, because that's what we have to show how absolutely illogical it is to believe that DNA could have come about by itself. So the odds of a sequence of 6,000 characters is roughly the same as any other sequence of 6,000 characters, but it's getting a pattern from order, and that's an entirely different situation. Now, let's go back to the flipping of the coin. The odds of getting 100 heads in a row is actually the same odds of any combination of 100. You say, that can't be. But it is. The actual odds of getting 100 heads in a row is the same as any combination of 100. But here's the difference. I specified what you had to do. That's information. That's what information is. Here's an illustration. There's two sentences here. 47 years ago. I think we understand that. That's a bunch of letters put together in a specific sequence. And then there's some hodgepodge here. A Ninny, Taw, Jill, Gymnic, Hydex, or whatever. That's just put together here. Did you know that if I were to go to a computer and type out on my computer those letters or those sequences, the odds of getting 47 years ago, by the way, Stephen Meyer did this for me, so I didn't count these. I hope they're actually the same. They're the same characters in both of these. And the odds of randomly doing that are the same. They're the same. But we understand one has information and one is useless. So you could put a bunch of base pairs together and it wouldn't mean a thing. They have to be lined up in the same, in the proper sequence for it to be information. One suggests something other than chance and the other one does not. The second one, that's chance. I could go up there and do that and get something similar to that. The first one, how likely would that be to get that specified pattern? I submit very, very unlikely. And so I'm going to give you a few. There's a lot of these. There's a lot of these that I could give. But one was derived by Sir Fred Hoyle in 1983. And he placed the odds of a single one-celled organism occurring by chance at 10 to the 40,000th power. Astronomical numbers, not numbers that are believable. One gene that has 300 amino acids. And if you understand, we talked about the codons. That's three nucleic acids that lined up to form a codon. So if you have 300 amino acids, that means you have about 1,000 of those base pairs. The probability of just one gene, and by the way, most genes have between 100 to 150 amino acids. This one, particular one, has 300. There's some that are much smaller, some that are larger, but that would be about average. The probability of lining those amino acids up to produce that particular gene is 20 to the 300th power or 10 to the 390th power. And I apologize, I don't have that on the board, but that's the odds. Does that sound like a high number to you? It's a number we can't fathom. You start getting into numbers like that, you can't fathom. To show you how ridiculously high a number that is, it's estimated that there's only 10 to the 69th power of atoms in our galaxy. And so I said 10 to the 390th power. What is that? I do the math real quick. That's five times that number? It ain't likely, is it? Our friend, once again, William Dembski, he came up with something called the universal probability bound. And he says, and he looks at a lot of other factors just besides amino acids, and he decided that the chance of life occurring spontaneously was 10 to the negative 150th power. And even before Dembski at the Y-Star Institute, it was 10 to the 195th power. These numbers are all different, you know, but what they are is they're huge. They're huge. This is from Robert Saver of MIT. The probability of achieving a functional sequence of amino acids is, quote unquote, exceedingly small, 1 to the 10 and 16th power. And then again, we talked about how many atoms are in our galaxy. So if you start believing that all that DNA in your body that produces proteins that are vital for life came about by chance, in my opinion, you've just tossed logic out the window. Don't you agree? You've thrown it away. It's not logical anymore. It's illogical. And I like this. This is a lot. We talked about Pennick yesterday and what he talked about being a Christian, how being a Christian demands a certain amount of logic, and that's what this class on evidence is all about. And Dembski has put it this way, and I can't put it any better. But premise one, and we talked about life has to either be chance or has to be somehow of necessity. He says life has occurred. We would agree with that one, wouldn't we? I mean, we're here. We're sitting in the pews. We're here. Life has occurred. Premise two, life is specified. Would you not agree with that? Of course. Very, very specified. We would also say that if life is due to chance, life has a very small probability. Did I not just show you that? extremely small. Specific events of small probability do not occur by chance. They just don't. And we know that life is not due to irregularity. Regularities are natural laws like gravity, the speed of light, the nuclear forces, so forth. Life is not due to that. And no scientist would agree to that. It's not due to irregularity. So life is either due to irregularity, a chance, or design. And the conclusion has to be design unless you're thinking illogically, in my opinion. You just have to throw logic out the door. Well, okay, we've settled the problem, haven't we? DNA, it has to have been directed. There has to have been intelligence behind it. And that intelligence had to be smarter than me and you sitting in our pews, because we couldn't have come up with that stuff. So then how can some scientists still hold to this molecules to man evolutionary theory? Most simply say it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. They use what's called the anthropic principle. We're going to talk about that. I'm going to give a real good illustration of that tomorrow. But basically, the anthropic principle is no explanation at all. It just says we're here, so it had to have happened. How do you like that explanation? That's a good one. We're here, so it had to have happened. And the fact that we're here witnessing it means it happened. That's the anthropic principle. Okay? I love that. Stephen Gould, he was an evolutionist. He's now passed away. He came up with something called punctuated evolution, by the way, because evolutionists, they realized they had trouble. This couldn't have occurred by chance, and it couldn't have occurred over no matter how many billions of years you give it. And so him and another fellow came up with punctuated equilibrium, which means we had to punctuate the process, had to speed it up. They didn't say how that happened, but they said it happened. But their theory has been basically thrown out the window, but others have kind of picked up that gauntlet and still now hold to some of that, and it's purely speculative. But even Stephen Gould said life had to be a glorious accident which required 60 trillion contingent events. He understands how improbable it is, and yet the evolutionists and the materialists believe it. Well, let's get to the human genome. I just said that the human genome came out in 2003, and since that time, the evolutionists have had a field day. They say, here we go. Here's proof. Here's proof of evolution. Why? Francis Collins points to several quote-unquote surprises found in the genome. There were things that they didn't necessarily expect to find. I'm not going to hit all of them. I'm going to hit the two or three that are the more important for our purposes, but the ones that are the most important. First, he was surprised about how little of the genome is used to code for protein. We just talked about protein synthesis and how important DNA is in the production of protein. And yet, only 1.5% of our DNA represents genes. And genes are what, when you talk about a gene, what is a gene? A gene is what codes for protein. So when you talk about a gene, that's what a gene is. Well, there's a lot of DNA that doesn't code for protein. Why would that cause evolutionists to have a field day? They say, well, why would a creator produce a lot of useless DNA? Ergo, that DNA must have been left over from evolution because it ain't doing anything now. It's useless. You know what they call it? They call it junk. Junk DNA. And that surprised them. They realized there was some junk out there in the DNA, they thought, but not, what would that number be, 98.5%, something like that? That was a surprise to Francis Collins. The second surprise was the number of genes in humans similar to other basic organisms. So what do I mean by that? Let's take the mouse, for example. There's a lot of DNA inside the mouse that is similar to your DNA. You have to trust me on this one. I'm not an evolutionist. I'm a creationist. I'm a believer, obviously, like you are. But there is a lot of DNA that's similar. And so that's what he said. He said, well, look at all the similar DNA that we see in other organisms. Some of them are even basic organisms like worms. You know, you share a few DNA sequences with worms? Well, you do. And that's what surprised him. And finally, the final thing we're going to discuss here is he also noticed, hey, there's a lot of similarity between humans and chimps. They're identical by 96%. Now, that actually is a little bit surprising because they thought they would be identical a lot more than that, more like 99%. And it turned out to be, when you start looking at the permutations and so forth, it wasn't 99%, it was 96%. Even though humans have 23 paired chromosomes and chimps have 24, this is confusing to me. We've gone from a superior being, I suppose, and yet we have less chromosomes. So what the evolutionists say is, well, in the evolution of man, two of those chromosomes merged together. They don't say how it happened. They just say it happened. So that's why we have 23 and they got 24. And by the way, I will make this comment. The number of chromosomes your body has, or the organism has nothing to do with how complex that organism is. There are protozoans that have thousands of chromosomes. So don't look. Starfish have hundreds of chromosomes, and you and I only have merely 23 pairs of chromosomes. A chimp's got more. But we're 96% similar. So are there answers to this? Because when this came out, I mean, really and truly, death bell to creationism. That's what it was. This settles it. We don't need the fossil record anymore. Remember the last lecture I had yesterday? I said they don't look at the fossil record anymore because they know the fossil record absolutely does not prove evolution. We studied that, and it does not. There is no fossil evidence that evolution has occurred. There's fossil evidence of evolution within species, okay, adaptation, but not fossil evidence that a change in kinds has occurred. So are there valid answers to the problem we see in the human genome? Because that's now what they look at. That's why I'm giving this series of talks tonight. It may seem like, again, a lot of science, but you're going to run into this. And this is big. The problem is, and I thought of this when I read some of this stuff, and I read The Language of God. I mean, I got the book and I read it. That's the name of Francis Collins' book, The Language of God. What worries me about that book is I read it and I'm going, wow, this is kind of neat. This is kind of good stuff. I don't have a lot of answers for this, but it's good stuff. And then when he claims to be a Christian, a believing Christian, a one that believes in the historicity and the miracles of Christ, it made me take pause for a minute. But even while reading that book, I'm saying, but wait, couldn't chromosomes be doing more than just making protein? We're talking about protein. But isn't there a possibility that maybe the chromosomes could be doing more than just making protein? Turns out that non-protein producing DNA produces many functions. It's not useless. I'm going to rattle this off. Don't have to remember this either. But DNA regulates transcription. It influences the folding of proteins. Proteins are important not just in how the DNA comes together in those nitrogen-based pairs, but how they are folded. If they're not folded just right, they don't work. Well, some of the DNA is involved in determining the folds of those proteins. They control RNA processing, editing, splicing. They're responsible for the repair of DNA. They're non-protein DNA is actually responsible for repairing itself. It aids in the immune defense. It regulates embryologic development. There is a lot of non-protein production that's going on in DNA. Bottom line is, there is no junk DNA. As we're discovering more and more about what DNA does, we're realizing there is no junk DNA. Some would say, well, what about mutations? We're going to address that real quick. Because aren't mutations the reason that evolution has occurred? Do mutations occur? Do sometimes those nitrogen bases not line up perfectly? Yes. Can't deny that. That'd be like putting our heads in the sand. Mutations do occur. But mutations make small changes in the organism. And when they make big changes in the organism, guess what happens? The organism dies. So the type of mutations that occur won't cause evolution, and the type of mutations that are needed would destroy the organism. It doesn't work. Mutations doesn't work. Besides that, tell me how a mutation would cause DNA to come together to begin with. It wouldn't happen. And so mutations don't, in my opinion, really help the evolutionists. But I thought about, why would God allow for mutations to occur? That may be a question you have. And some mutations are very bad, and I can't It's not in the course of this lesson to explain why death and other things occur. Well, we can study that at a later time with Bubba and others. But right now, why would God allow mutations to occur? Well, we talked about adaptation of the organism. I think it's so adaptation can occur. That's what I think. I think that's why mutations are there. There are times where adaptation can occur, and it's through mutations that can occur. Now, I may be wrong about that. I may be wrong about that, but to me, that's at least one reason. We do know that mutations do occur, and sometimes there is change in the species, but not change in kinds. How about homology, though? What about this idea that there's a lot of DNA that is shared by organisms, that the mouse has a lot of DNA that you and I have? What about that? What would your answer be to that? To me, it's the old argument of homology. Would it be surprising that the DNA that produces the protein of your heart would not be a whole lot different than the DNA that produces the protein of the heart of a horse? Would that be surprising? It wouldn't be to me. So that the idea of common DNA, common genetics, it goes back to the homology argument. That's what it goes back to. And so we've already talked about mutations, so I won't belabor that. Well, how about, and we talked about how the evolution to occur, minor slight mutations and DNA will not work. Large-scale change in DNA destroys the organisms. How about the similarity between chimps and humans? There is a 4% difference. That doesn't seem like a big difference, does it? It actually is a very, very big difference. And there's something known as Haldane's dilemma. And there was a guy by the name of J.B.S. Haldane. And he came up with an estimation of how many mutations it would take to get from a chimpanzee to a human being. Now, I don't believe in mutations causing that change, but we're going to use his numbers for the time being, for the sake of what we're studying here. And Haldane said, for evolutionists, and everybody pretty much agrees with Haldane's statistics, 40 million total separate mutation events separate humans and chimps. That's how many mutations it would take if mutations could change an organism into a different kind for humans to become chimps. So Haldane calculated that number, and he got a number, he calculated an average mutation rate of 10 to the 6th power for a population size of 1 million, and that number was comparable to evolutionists, and given that time scale, it implies, somebody read that number for me, 150 with 3, 6, 9 zeros behind it, huge number of these pre-human transitional missing links, whatever you want to call it. Where are they? Where's the fossil record? If you had that many pre-humans, you would have innumerable amount of fossils. And so it's been referred to as Haldane's dilemma. It's a big dilemma. What does God say? God says, let us make man in our own image. It's not the DNA that separates us from other organisms. It's not the DNA. There's a big difference, as I just pointed out. But it's the soul that separates us. And God chose that chemical to produce life, produce our life. But it's not that that separates us. So it's not terribly surprising to me that we share some of the same DNA sequences. But it's not as much as you might think. It's not nearly as much as the evolutionist would have you think. And there's a lot of sequences that some animals have that other animals don't. You know what they call those? They call those orphan genes. They like to give them a name, D. They call them orphan genes. These are orphans. They are not part of that evolutionary sequence. They're orphans. There's no explanation for orphan genes from an evolutionary standpoint. None whatsoever. And we're finding more and more orphan genes as time goes along. Well, I know the time's running quick, so running by real quick, I'm going to give you what's a death blow to evolution. You know, they said we have a death blow to creation. I'm going to give you, besides what we've already talked about, I'm going to give you a death blow to evolution, and it's called epigenetics. And again, there won't be tested on this, but here's the deal. DNA does not by itself direct how individual proteins are assembled into larger systems, such as cell type, tissues, organs, and body plans. Evolutionists use DNA. It's mutations through DNA that causes the change that causes us to evolve in the way we have. But there's more to it than DNA, and it's called epigenetics, the word epi, outside the gene. There's more to it than that. And I'm going to run through these quickly. But what are examples of epigenetics? Well, you have microtubules made up of the cytoskeleton that generate from each other. They're not DNA. Histones are evolved in the sequencing of protein, regulate storage and activation of DNA. They're not DNA. Centrosomes from the mother egg decides on the polarity and replicates itself without DNA. There are ion channels. There are electromagnetic fields that have significant morphologic effects that are not derived by DNA. There's even something called the sugar code that influences embryonic development and protein patterns and are transmitted directly from parent to daughter membranes. Evolutionists have absolutely no answer for epigenetics. None. They are not immutable to mutations either. You can't mutate these non-DNA structures. The organism will die if you do that. So, let's summarize. I appreciate your patience. DNA, genetics, and the genome offer no more proof for evolution than homology did in the past or the fossil record for that as well. They don't offer any more proof. The genome was not a death bell to creationism. In fact, quite the opposite. And I'm not afraid of the science of the human genome. To me, it's very presumptuous to say evolution is a fact. And did we not read yesterday where we've been told it is a fact over and over again? It's not even worth arguing anymore. It's a fact. It is very presumptuous to say evolution is a fact when it's impossible to determine how even a single functioning protein could have occurred naturally. That's a presumptuous statement. Case for design. Stephen Meyer, in his book, once again, The Signature of the Cell, says, the case of design restores Western thought to the possibility that human life may have a purpose or sign to it beyond the temporary material utility. No joke. You know, and we'll close with this scripture. One of my favorites as well, Ecclesiastes 12:13-14. What is the purpose of man? You know, I feel sad for people that live their life without any purpose, don't you? To me, that they're the saddest people that think this is it. And that's what evolution has basically produced, a society that thinks this is all there is. And I think some of the mayhem and the sin that's going on in our society, as we mentioned by Michael Denton yesterday, is directly related to the theory of evolution because there's no consequences anymore. You can do whatever you want to because when you're dead, you're just dead. That's not what God says. He says there is a purpose. He says in conclusion, or the conclusion, the Ecclesiastes writer says, the wise man, when all has been heard, it is to fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. I know a man that once said, when you miss heaven, you just missed it all. And that's absolutely true. Because when you've missed heaven, you've missed it all. And I don't want people to be lost because they believe a lie. You can hang on to your... By the way, where does Francis Collins think DNA come from? God put it here. Even Francis Crick, the discoverer of DNA, realized how just utterly impossible it was for that molecule to have appeared spontaneously. Where do you think he came? He said it came from. Outer space. That just displaces the location, doesn't it? No, there's purpose to life. There's a reason we're here. We're here to fear God and to keep his commandments. And we know that one of those commandments during this new dispensation of the New Testament was to believe on his son, Jesus Christ, who created everything that we talked about tonight and some of the laws we're going to talk about tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to shift gears. It's not going to be on evolution. You're done with that. Some of you are probably saying yay, but that we're moving on, and we're going to look at those laws and constants that are out there and how improbable they are as well, and look at the scientific explanation for those as well. But these were all created by Jesus Christ. All of those laws, we're still discovering them. We don't know them all yet, and the ones we do know probably are going to have to be modified. But they were all made by Jesus Christ at the beginning of time. And it's him that we must put our faith in. It's him that we have to believe in. And if we believe Jesus, Jesus said we had to repent of our sins and be baptized for to have our sins remitted. Do you know of any way to get to heaven, D, that you can go without having your sins remitted? Bubba, do you know of any way? Brother Mark, do you know any way? I don't either. Brother Dickey? No, none of us. Your sins have to be remitted. And that only comes through baptism. That's the only way I read in my New Testament where sins are remitted. And that's at the act of an obedient heart through baptism. There's nothing special in the water. We know that. It's an act of a good conscience. So if you have that desire or any other desire that you might need the help of the church for, we ask that you come now as we stand and sing.